भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ज्ञानञ्जनशलाखया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे मुखं करोति वाचमुपं गमनं गायते गिरिं यत्कृपातमहं श्रीगुरुं दीनतारिणं जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवसनि गौरवन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे Hare Krishna. Good evening. Welcome to our guests. Nice to have you here, Janava's mom, Mother Parvati. I don't know your names, but welcome. Okay, chapter 2, text 45. Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nishtraigunyo Bhavarjuna Nirdvandvo Nitya Sattvasto Niryoga Kshemaatmavan Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nishtraigunyo Bhavarjuna Nirdvandvo Nitya Sattvasto Niryoga Kshemaatmavan Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nistraigunyo Bhavarjuna Nirdvandvo Nitya Sattvasto Niryoga Kshemaatmavan Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nishtraigunyo Bhavarjuna Trigunya, pertaining to the three modes of material nature. Vishaya, on the subject matter. Vedaha, Vedic literatures. Nishtraigunya, transcendental to the three modes of material nature. Bhava, be. Arjuna, O Arjuna. Nirdvandva, without duality. Nitya Sattva Staha. In a pure state of spiritual existence. Niryoga Kshema. Free from ideas of gain and protection. Atmavan. Established in the self. The Vedas deal mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. O Arjuna, become transcendental to these three modes. Be free from all dualities and from all anxieties for gain and safety, and be established in the self. Okay, the Vedas deal mainly with the subject. Let's respond. The Vedas deal mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. O Arjuna, become transcendental to these three modes. Be free from all dualities and from all anxieties for gain and safety, and be established in the self. Okay, purport. All material activities involve actions and reactions in the three modes of material nature. They are meant for fruitive results which cause bondage in the material world. The Vedas deal mostly with fruitive activities to gradually elevate the general public from the field of sense gratification to a position on the transcendental plane. Arjuna, as a student and friend of Lord Krishna, is advised to raise himself to the transcendental position of Vedanta, philosophy, where, in the beginning, there is Brahma Jigyas, or questions on the supreme transcendence. All the living entities who are in the material world are struggling very hard for existence. For them, the Lord, after creation of the material world, gave the Vedic wisdom advising how to live and get rid of the material entanglement. When the activities for sense gratification, namely the Karma Kanda chapter, are finished, then the chance for spiritual realization is offered in the form of the Upanishads, which are part of different Vedas, as the Bhagavad Gita is part of the fifth Veda, namely the Mahabharata. The Upanishads mark the beginning of transcendental life. As long as the material body exists, there are actions and reactions in the material modes. One has to learn tolerance in the face of dualities, such as happiness and distress, or cold and warmth. And by tolerating such dualities, become free from anxieties regarding gain and loss. This transcendental position is achieved in full Krishna consciousness when one is fully dependent on the goodwill of Krishna. So, the first two words are the Vedas. So already when we start reading the purport and the first two words are the Vedas, I guess maybe it's my conditioning because I've taken the course with Gopinath Acharya Prabhu on Vedas and Upanishads, that straight away when someone says the Vedas, I think, okay, sacrifice, many brahmanas, lots of chanting of Vedic hymns and offering swaha. Okay, so usually that's what comes to mind. And this is what the purport is actually saying, that the Vedas deal mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. Because what we learn that basically these sacrifices that are outlined in the Vedas are generally meant for some kind of material benefit. That they are done in very strict accordance with rules and regulations according to the different parts of the Vedas. And one is following these rules and regulations in order to gain either wealth, good family, good progeny, or attain to the heavenly planets where there is a greater chance for sense gratification. But these rituals can never give one the liberation that they desire from the bondage of interacting with these different modes, three modes of material nature. And hence in the purport, it's stated that the Upanishads mark the beginning of transcendental life. And from this we know that Vedanta, or the Upanishads, is actually the end of the Vedas, or the conclusion, the essence of the Vedas. So first you're going, well, if you're looking at the Vedas, first we're going through all these different phases on how to have good progeny and how to gain kingdoms on earth and, you know, live very opulently. And at the end, at the conclusion of all those processes or sacrifices to gain these kind of things, there's the Veda Anta, or the end of the Vedas, which is the Upanishads, and that's where transcendental life begins, where we actually understand that, okay, now that we've gone through all these elaborate processes to gratify our senses for so long, here is now a chance to actually rise above those modes. And the Upanishads outlines the specific knowledge that we need. Upanishads are known as the Jnana Khand, whereas Vedanta, whereas the Vedas are known as the Karma Khand. So this Jnana Khand is actually what we need to learn how to transcend the modes of nature, which are offered to us for our pleasure in the Karma Khand. And these three modes of material nature, as we are familiar with, tamas, rajas, and sattva. And I was reflecting a little bit on what it means to transcend these three modes of material nature. So after one transcends the platform of passion and ignorance, one so-called gets to the stage of goodness. But even the mode of goodness is seen as contaminated. It still falls under the category of the three modes of material nature. So the mode of goodness is still a material mode. Does anyone have any ideas on why the mode of goodness is still seen as a material mode? Or why is it still seen as contaminated? Yes, Shama. That's one part of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to be one thing that comes to mind with more goodness is also, like you said, violence and whatever. But if it's not on the level of Krishna consciousness, then it's still material. Mm-hmm. And the world keep repeating.
That is true. Because those who are in the mode of goodness, you have to have certain qualifications, certain amount of piety to be in the mode of goodness. But yes, they still go to Swargaloka or the Bhurbhubha, these kind of planets. They're still within the material realm, they're not transcendental. This transcendental platform. Oh, yes. Sorry, cool. Very good. Yes. Actually, that is the answer I was looking for. It's exactly that. Rick Prabhu was just saying that even goodness in the material world is not purely goodness. It's always mixed with passion and ignorance. And that's exactly the answer I was looking for, that the mode of goodness, as part of the three modes of material nature, is considered contaminated because it's still tinged with the modes of passion and ignorance. One needs to rise above that mode of goodness to come to a stage of Shuddha Sattva, or pure goodness. In the material world, any quality, goodness, passion or ignorance, is contaminated, because even the ignorance or the passion is not purely passion or not purely ignorance. It's always like shades of grey and mixtures of the other modes within these modes. Either one mode is predominant and it has these, or it changes because, yeah, this is the nature of the material world. Everything changes, including our minds and the way we think, the way we feel, the way we will. From one day to the next, we're still not even the same person, based on our level of consciousness and the modes that we interact on different levels based on these modes. Okay. Even the quality of goodness here in the material world is not free from the tinges of passion and ignorance. But in the transcendental world, only pure goodness without tinges of passion and passion and ignorance exists. So in the transcendental world, this Shuddha Sattva prevails. There is no other modes. Everything comes and is manifest from Shuddha Sattva, which is our pure original constitution position. And since the Shuddha Sattva existence is under the direction of the internal potency of the Lord, in this state the activities of material consciousness stop. It's like when we take shelter from the Lord's external potency to the Lord's internal potency, there is you wouldn't call it a marginal shift, you would call it a drastic shift. Because there are many things that are allowed to go on in the material sphere that aren't allowed to, aren't permissible in the transcendental sphere. And this is one of them. That when we reach a stage where we are actually ready to let go of functioning under the three modes of material nature, we come under the Lord's internal energy. And this is a transition from the three modes of material nature unto the stage or the platform of Shuddha Sattva. And so the idea of the Vedas and Upanishads and dealing with these three modes of material nature, actually I brought my Vedas and Upanishads handbook with me to the class so that if anyone, I'm going to pass it around, if anyone wants to browse through it, it's full with passages and a lot of my notes and scribbling, and because this kind of subject matter is really dense. Yeah, it has very small 1 or 2 line and 5 line excerpts about the Vedas and Upanishads and what they're like. So you guys can have a look at it. Because most of the time we speak about the Vedas and Upanishads, but we actually have no idea what's contained in the Vedas and Upanishads. We have no practical experience of either following these kind of things or even learning about it unless we take a course such as that. So I just thought to share it with everyone. Mm-hmm. And here, Krishna is not just instructing Arjuna that, okay, now you should just get out of these three modes and, you know, that's it. He says, be free from the dualities and from all anxieties. And so he's basically saying to Arjuna, as it says towards the end of the purport, that you should actually become tolerant. One has to learn tolerance in the face of dualities such as happiness and distress, or cold and warmth. And by such tolerating, dualities become free from anxieties regarding gain and loss. So I was wondering about the word tolerance. It's a word that we use often. But the definition of tolerance, I guess people have very different definitions according to each individual, what tolerance actually means, or their level of tolerance also. So I looked up on the dictionary for a dictionary meaning first of what tolerance means. It has synonyms such as endurance or fortitude. And technically, the meaning of tolerance is the capacity to endure pain or hardship. That's one of them. The other one is a fair and permissive attitude towards those whose opinions, practices, race, religion, nationality, etc., differ from one's own. Another meaning is that it's a liberal, undogmatic viewpoint, or interest or concern for ideas and opinions or practices that are foreign to one's own. So basically, it speaks about sympathy for beliefs or practices that differ from someone's own ideas, viewpoints, or their own practices also. Well, I mean, this is still tolerance based on the three modes of material nature because it speaks in relation to the material world and how we interact with people on maybe a material level. And we throw around the word tolerance a lot sometimes without actually understanding the full purport of it, even in this context, let alone the spiritual context. But even on the context of tolerating, sometimes it means that it would mean to someone that, okay, tolerance would just mean standing there and not saying anything, you know, really like someone shouting at you and blaspheming you or something else, and you know, you're just standing there and taking it all. I mean, would that be tolerance? I don't know. I mean, it's usually confused with the state of indifference. If someone's indifferent to something, yeah, they don't really care very much. So they're not tolerating very much either, you know. If you're indifferent to something, you just don't care. You have a give-a-damn attitude. So what are you tolerating then? You know, it's like, if you have an indifferent mood, it means that this is of no importance, no value to you. It's marked by a lack of interest, enthusiasm, or concern for something. Whereas we understood from the definition of tolerance that it's usually a liberal or undogmatic viewpoint that one needs to have, not a mood of indifference or I don't care. And the other extreme of tolerance also is undue tolerance. It's like we are said that we should, I mean, we are told that we should be tolerant, yes, but is it every circumstance that we should be tolerant in? I was wondering about that, so I looked it up, and the idea of undue tolerance is also something that could be seen as adharmic, because there are instances where one has to act. Like a Vaishnava never mistreats anyone as his inferior. And when there is mistreatment of those who are under his care or dominion, then generally Kshatriyas, Vaishnavas or Kshatriyas, act upon that. Vaishnavas generally exhibit deep forbearance, which means they are generally very, very tolerant. Like usually when a Vaishnava is themselves insulted, we've seen examples like Maharaj Ambarish, where they are personally insulted, but they don't really take to the insult to heart. Instead, his mood was to accept. He accepted and he absorbed himself in the meditation of Krishna instead of counter-cursing. Although he could counter-curse, he didn't. He was ready to accept it right there and then. And the whole of Bhagavatam was spoken for the benefit of Maharaj Parikshit, who was also cursed and who was also very much capable of counter-cursing the Brahmana boy, but didn't. Instead, he tolerated and he accepted, okay, 7 days to live. What should I do now? So these kind of personalities, they have exhibited very deep forbearance or tolerance. Although, you know, if someone curses you to death in 7 days, how would you feel towards that person? How would you feel for yourself? You know, if we were in Maharaj Parikshit's shoes, he has so much power to do that, would we act in the same way? You just humbly accept? Oh, yeah, it's an amazing exhibition of tolerance, of deep conviction and understanding of our philosophy. So even if others are envious and spiteful of him, he never retaliates based on these kind of feelings. On the contrary, he prays for the well-being of his tormentors. So examples of this would be Prahlad Maharaj, who was tormented in many ways by his father, the great demon Hiranyakashipu. He was tormented again and again. And when the Lord appeared to him and asked him, Prahlad, what do you desire? What did Prahlad Maharaj desire? Exactly. His father, the first thing he thought about was the welfare of his tormentor. The person who tried to kill him repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly. Please let my father. I don't want him to go to hell. Another example would be Srila Haridas Thakur. This amazing personality was dragged and beat in 22 marketplaces. Beat, like, not, you know, like, really beaten up. And yet, his constant prayer while being beaten by these miscreants in 22 marketplaces was, "Lord, please forgive them. Please don't harm them. They don't know what they do." He prayed for their protection. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it said, was waiting with his Sudarshan disc, ready to kill all of them. But because Srila Haridas Thakur, our Namacharya, was praying so fervently to the Lord, "Please don't." He was praying for their protection. The Lord couldn't act. And the Lord didn't kill them for that reason. That his pure devotee is praying, you know, "Don't, have mercy on them." And it said that Srila Haridas Thakur couldn't understand why. He just couldn't understand why he was being beaten so brutally, so badly. He couldn't understand why he couldn't feel any of that. And later on, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu revealed to him, "You know, actually, Haridas, when this was going on, I was ready to kill those people. But because of your prayer, I was held back. I couldn't do that. And the reason that you felt minimal or nothing when all of this was going on is because I personally came and sheltered you." And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed Srila Haridas Thakur his back, where there was lashings and bruises and all different colors from the severe brutality that was taking place. So these devotees, that's an extreme exhibition of tolerance. But when things like this are happening in their lives, we see how they're able to tolerate it and actually go a step beyond just tolerating, but praying for the welfare of the people who are tormenting them. Because they have full faith, they have such strong faith in the Lord. And sometimes we think, why do we have to go through such negative experiences? Doesn't the Lord know how I feel about Him and towards Him and this and that? And these are Namacharya and, you know, pure devotees, but they're still going through these tormentive, how do you call it? Well, leelas, but experiences. But yet, Prahlad Maharaj had unflinching faith. Srila Haridas Thakur had unflinching faith that if I surrender to the Lord and I have faith in Him, what else can I do? Amrish Maharaj was ready. There is a saying that if there's anyone that wants to harm you, and if Krishna wants to protect you, then no one can actually harm you. But if you don't have the protection of Krishna, yeah, exactly. If you don't have protection and shelter, basically, because Krishna doesn't directly want to kill anyone. Doesn't really. But yeah, no one, absolutely no one and nothing can save us. That's a point about tolerance. And yeah, the last point that I want to actually speak about that I got from this verse and purport was goodwill. Or the idea of goodwill. Fully dependent on the goodwill of Krishna. So this was the point I was making about the faith and the goodwill of Krishna. And we always see how Srila Prabhupada used to sign his letters at the end. "Your ever well wisher." And a lot can be elaborated on what that actually means. But generally it means a friend to all. A genuine well-wishing friend. A caring person. Someone who is ready to extend themselves in whatever capacity they need to another individual or another entity. Yeah, the feeling of approval, support, benevolent interest, concern, or someone putting a willing effort in. So Srila Prabhupada is genuinely concerned about all of us. He expressed his genuine concern to those around him. And even in writing that one line in a letter, besides the content of the letter, still, that kind of summarized his being and his mission there also, that he was the genuine well-wishing friend of everyone. And he signed off as such because he meant it. He genuinely meant it. And that is also shown by his actions, the way he lived, the way he interacted with people. People have a very keen sense to understand whether you mean good or you mean harm. You might not even speak the same language. You might not even, know each other very well. But already, like on a first meeting or the first few interactions with people, sometimes you have a sense. We don't know exactly what it is, but we have a sense about people. You can tell sometimes. Like even how children react with adults sometimes. You could tell whether they feel a sense of security or safety with that person or not. It's just a kind of sense that someone can get. So just like that, people are very sensitive to understanding these things that are not necessarily said or spoken or conveyed in a gross way. But people can understand whether you have their genuine interest at heart or whether you have some kind of self-interested motivation in guiding them or trying to do or get them to do what you want. But Srila Prabhupada was able to guide, advise, direct so many projects, so many people, not because he had some kind of self-motivated interest, but because he had interest in following the orders of his spiritual master and Krishna. So that kind of genuine concern, a genuine well-wishing person who has real goodwill, someone like that can do things like that because people can perceive it, people can understand it, and they trust and have faith in that. Yeah, so I'd like to stop there. And if there are any comments, questions, corrections, please. Srila Prabhupada ki. Go Premanani. Oh, and there's some Mahaprasad for distribution. From Mahaprabhu. Yeah, the Mahaprabhu.